I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jerry Ferraccio. He is director and production designer of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which opened this past weekend. It's the Santa Fe Shakespeare Society production, and actor Patrick Briggs, who plays Bottom. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And so I find it amazing, Jerry, you have produced, this is your eighth Midsummer Night's Dream?
That I've been involved in. I haven't produced them all. As a director or an actor and or a designer, I've been involved in, this will be my eighth one.
Mm-hmm. And what's it like for you to continue doing them year after year?
I started in 1988. Midsummer just keeps getting deeper and richer every time I look at it. When I was a young man, in my first Midsummer, it was the romp part of it. It was the goofy part of it. It was how can we make the audience laugh without paying attention to the story. I mean, Mechanicals just took the whole story, and it was like a sideshow shtick. Now, hitting my eighth one, I have to say that this play is so rich and so multi-layered and so texturally abundant with light and dark images, the cost of love, magic woven, not just the supernatural magic, but the magic of falling in love with somebody and how that transports you. I'm looking forward to my 10th.
Very interesting. Can you talk about that in more detail?
Mm-hmm. Just the fact that the Midsummer, you go out and everyone tries to solve their problems by going out into the forest. And in Shakespeare's day, the forest was that terrifying area outside the city's wall where there was no protection. There were, of course, no street lights. There were no police. No one was out there to save you. And you see this motif in fairy tales. You know, the princess goes through the woods, or then the hero's journey. They all go out to some uncivilized place, and there's a transformation. So that's the really exciting thing about Midsummer that a lot of people lack, is that there's a reaction, either the forest will be our salvation, let's go, like the lovers, or the forest is not a place we want to be, like the Mechanicals. What do you mean we're going out in the forest to rehearse a play? It makes no sense. And that kind of just wonderful underbelly of darkness, Dream's not all positive.
Right, exactly.
I mean, if you look at the play, Hermia has a terrifying dream. She's the first person who has a dream in the play, and it's about a serpent eating her heart away. So there's this recurrent stake, recurrent price for pursuing what you want in a play.
So the character of Bottom is a... first of all, explain when he just said the word Mechanicals. Explain what that means.
It means they're hardworking men. They work every day. You know, all day long at their stalls in Athens.
And so basically craftsmen, artisans.
Definitely craftsmen, artisans.
And so it's a kind of, what would you call it, more slapstick and more common humor in some ways?
In a lot of ways. Yes, very common. You know, they're not exactly the sharpest tools in the shed. But they're using every one of their little brain cells. All the time, or at least trying. At least I do.
Right. Tell us about, for people who haven't seen Midsummer Night's Dream, tell us about your character.
Well, like I said, Bottom is an artisan. He's somebody that I know very well. You know, he's my friends. He's myself. I go out there every day and work. And he's kind of the leader of the Mechanicals in a way. They all look to him for inspiration and to get them through, to carry it through.
This production is taking place at the band shell at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Tell us about that space.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that the Santa Fe University of Art and Design have been so accommodating. We are so grateful to them. I walked in and said, I need a space. We'd like to do Summer Shakespeare again this year. And they said, let me show you three spaces. They were wonderful. So to Laura Nunley, bless you, my dear, if you're listening. You are wonderful. The space is very interesting. We're not actually performing in the band shell. We're using it as our set backdrop and as our acoustical bounce to augment the voices.
Nice.
And we are down on the concrete pad in front. And then in front of that is a lawn in which people may bring picnic blankets, low lawn chairs, and we have some picnic tables toward the back. So it's festival seating, and we're right up against the edge of the concrete pad, and that's where the first picnic blanket will be. So we will be less than 2 or 3 feet away from the performers.
In your face.
Yes, kind of like Shakespeare was.
Right. Is that true? I mean, when Shakespeare was performed in Shakespeare's time, the audience was pretty much on top of them?
They were pretty much on top of the audience. The best reconstruction that we can figure out with modern archaeology is that they were on a raised platform, and people were literally standing against the platform, leaning on the platform, looking up. So that close.
What do we know about audiences of that time? I mean, we have sort of stereotypes about people talking and throwing tomatoes and things like that.
Oh, tomatoes were too precious. They would have been hazelnuts, which sting more.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when they did the archaeological excavation for the rose, they found a layer of hazelnut shells, because that's the period equivalent of popcorn for us in a movie theater. So you know that horrible layer of goo when you go into the movie theater and step through that? Well, their goo was hazelnuts crunching underfoot. What we know is they packed them in. Yeah, it was about a penny, but a penny bought you a loaf of bread back then, so that kind of gives you an idea of what they were spending. And there were smaller theaters. You know, they just found... just in the last year, the first two theaters in Elizabethan England, the Curtain and the Theater, and those excavations are going on. Now, I've actually been in the Rose excavation, and wow, was it intimate. I mean, not even as much space as in this room.
As the Santa Fe Baking Company?
Yeah, well, not the Santa Fe Baking Company, just this little area we're in. It was about half of that, and so people were just packed in. It was a great, raucous, in-your-face event.
And not what you would call a kind of elitist theater experience.
Never. Not at all. In fact, elitist theater is one of my little pet peeves, as you can tell by my physical reaction. Sorry, audience.
He waved his hands in the air.
Be gone. Aroint thee, witch. Shakespeare was for the masses. Yeah. Everybody came. Everybody should be able to come. That's the goal of the society. That's why we formed a society instead of a theater company. When... Monte del Sol Charter School contacted us and said, could you bring Othello to us? We went, yes. And we brought a 2-day presentation of Othello there. We do charity fundraisers. We did a fundraiser last year for the Scottish Rites Temple. We did a staged reading. We did a staged reading of Midsummer there, and that kind of was the birth of the idea to do this year. It's meant for everybody, and it's completely understandable. Every production that I do, you remember this from Much Ado About Nothing. Patrick was also in Much Ado last year with me. Every day someone came and said, why did you modernize it, which I never do, or why did you translate it into English, which just cracks me up. It's like, we didn't translate it. We just understand what we're doing, and we have good actors.
Right, so. That's the key. If you understand what you're saying, the audience will understand what you're saying.
I heard a guy last year give a presentation on Shakespeare and Shakespeare's language in particular. And there is this kind of idea that we understand Shakespeare despite the fact that we don't know this vocabulary of Elizabethan English. And what this guy did was he took a passage and said, okay, how many words in here do you actually know? And it turns out that everybody knows about 90% of the words. And what we don't understand is not actually the vocabulary, it's the metaphors, it's the imagery, it's the way of getting language across. I thought that was very important.
Right. That's something that I point out when we talk about this, is that in Shakespeare's day, sentences often were over 50 words long. And today, they're 9 to 11 words long.
Right.
We parse our information, we strip it of any beauty, and we just left brain facts, just the facts, ma'am, and we hit people with it in little bites. And in Shakespeare's day, people luxuriated in the imagery. You know, instead of saying, I know where Titania is tonight, put this love juice in her eyes. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where ox lips and the nodding violet grows, quite over canopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine. There sleeps Titania some time of the night, lulled in these flowers with dances and delight. And there the snake throws her enameled skin, weed wide enough to wrap a fairy in, and with the juice of this, I'll streak her eyes and make her full of hateful fantasies. How long is that, right?
One sentence.
Yeah. Well, right. Basically.
Yeah, one or
one thought, two thoughts.
Beautiful sentence, and in fact, if we pay attention, we do understand
yes,
it.
Yes, yes.
Indeed.
Absolutely. It's English. And it was interesting for most people, they call that Old English. Well, first of all, it's not. It's early modern English. It's 400 years younger. We're speaking Old English if you think about the development of a language.
What do you mean?
Well, in Shakespeare's day, they were coining words. They were fresh minting them. They were inventing things. Shakespeare himself is credited with it's a widely varying number, but several words that were never used the way they were before. Well, now we have rules about, for instance, in Hamlet, Hamlet says, and that should learn us. There's a divinity that shapes our ends, instead of that should teach us.
Right.
Right. Well, now we know that's totally against them. That's totally against the new rules that we've invented. So our language has aged 400 years since mm-hmm. Shakespeare's time.
That's very interesting. But, we're coining words all the time.
Well, we are, but we've also got we've also, in the last 100 years, had an upswing of technology that's unprecedented
right.
in the world. I mean, we've got English is now the most common language for technology and medicine because we're the
right.
forerunners. So
yeah, I might not learn you something, but I'll friend you.
You'll friend me. Exactly. Exactly. It never ends. Well, Dylan Thomas was also an amazing coiner
yeah.
of words. So it's never ended. But when you look at the sheer bulk of what Shakespeare's done, he has formed our language.
We're talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream, directed by Jerry Ferraccio and also Patrick Briggs, who's playing Bottom. So tell us more about the Shakespeare Society, the Santa Fe Shakespeare Society.
The Santa Fe Shakespeare Society came out of an idea over a year ago on Shakespeare's celebrated birthday. We did a staged reading of some of his most popular works at the Collected Works bookstore. And I was chatting with some people in town who just really love Shakespeare. And it occurred to me, and one of the people misspoke and called it, I think, a Shakespeare Guild. And it just occurred to me that we didn't need a theater company. I had been part of the old Shakespeare in Santa Fe. In fact, that's how I discovered Santa Fe. I was invited to come out and audition in 1997 and played Autolycus. And it just occurred to me that Shakespeare itself needs to be brought. And what better than a Shakespeare Society? If you're not interested in the production aspect, we read every Sunday. We just read the text every Sunday aloud.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 11 to 1 at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, Benildas Hall, room 100. Or you can check our website, www.sfshakespeare.org.
SFShakespeare.org.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. In fact, what's fun is we usually try to unite them when we do a production. So we are actually reading Midsummer and doing Midsummer, and some people are in, some people go to the reading and then are in the involved with the show. But we go to schools. I mean, anything Shakespeare that isn't naughty, we would, and maybe even then, we would be willing to do. And so that the society is really about people who just really love Shakespeare's work, production, education, activities, events. We're just all involved.
And you also, Patrick, participate in these readings. Is that right? Do you go to these?
Occasionally.
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 Because I was going to say, just sitting around and reading it aloud and hearing it, not really having to be involved in blocking or acting or anything, mm-hmm. I would think would deepen your relationship to the piece.
Well, it does give you the opportunity to analyze different sentences, how they fit, how they work, what the meaning is, what other meanings could be, and what you can take out of any particular passage. So it's a good chance to just analyze the script moment by moment by moment.
Now, have you done a lot of Shakespeare yourself?
I've done some. I was a member of the company of players for the American Stratford Festival Theater in Connecticut for 5 years.
Nice.
Yes, it was. It was very nice. I got to train with some amazing people, work with some amazing people, and it really brought Shakespeare home for me.
What have been some of your favorite roles?
Benedict of Much Ado is my absolute favorite role.
And
of,
why is
of
that?
Because he's witty. He's how do I explain it?
Well, I think we also discovered in rehearsal last year that he's also vulnerable and looking for love. He's just denying it because it hasn't come to him yet. on some level.
Yes, he's like, you know, he's like all men, kind of looking for love in the wrong places.
Unlike women who are just got it right. What about you, Jerry?
As far as what?
Acting.
My favorite role so far, I've been acting since I was five, so it's been 41 years for me. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and then I was a professional actor for 15 years. My favorite role so far has been Prospero in The Tempest. I got to do that in 2002 in Oregon. And, you know, when he forgives his brother who put him and his 3-year-old daughter on a boat to die of starvation, and he looks at his brother and says, "And for you, sir, whom to call brother would even infect my mouth? I do forgive thy rankest faults, all of them." People in the audience would burst into tears. And then you realize the end of Shakespeare's career is all about forgiveness.
Oh, how fascinating.
Forgiving these huge things. I mean, Leontes in The Winter's Tale does this horrible thing. He basically is responsible for death, and several people die, and this, you know, Hermione has to stay hidden for several years and all this stuff. And at the end, they're like, "We forgive you." Which is not forgiveness a superpower?
Yeah.
Isn't not the most amazing thing in the world? So Shakespeare got it. It was towards the end of his life.
Right.
But he got it. And so that role, Prospero, really just sends me. I played Oberon twice, and I've been Hamlet, and done some things in Macbeth, and crazy little... I love little third lord from the left roles. That's what I call... You know, no lying, just hold the spear and bow and get out of... I mean, those are just as important as the Macbeths and the Hamlets.
Are they?
Oh, absolutely. One weak link in the chain of a Shakespeare production, and the whole thing just collapses. So I'm very... When I cast... I don't care if you have 2 lines or 100,000 lines. You know, you are absolutely as important, and nobody gets. I think you would find that's true, would you not, Patrick?
Absolutely.
You've worked on 2 shows with me. Everybody's an artist up there. It's wonderful.
And so you've got some terrific people in all of these roles in *Midsummer Night's Dream*.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Some wonderful
it's
students.
Tight.
Oh, please.
No, I was just saying, it's a nice, tight show.
Yeah.
It is very good.
Students from the Santa Fe University?
One that's graduated, a couple that are still attending. We have some people with, like Patrick, who have amazing credits. And the wonderful thing is they're mixed. For instance, Helena just got back from performing in London. And then one of the other lovers has never appeared on stage before. So it's this wonderful just mix through the whole thing. It wasn't like I cast all of you with great experience have to be the mechanicals or be the lovers or
right.
be the court. It's just this one. And everybody is, I don't want to say homogenized. Everyone has risen to Shakespeare's words and are inspired. And so you've got this effect of this wonderful, energetic cast all operating on this high level.
The play is A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare, directed by Jerry Faraccio, who is also the production designer, and Patrick Briggs plays Nick Bottom. And it goes through the 12th of August, so this is a long run.
It's a six-week run.
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always at 6 o'clock?
Yes,
6 o'clock.
Because of the sun.
Yes,
because
natural
of lighting.
Natural
right.
lighting,
natural
exactly.
Lighting.
You know... It really informs Shakespeare when you do Shakespeare right up against people under the same kind of conditions that he did. I wish we had the globe, but this is just joyful, outdoor. I mean, remember, the globe had no roof.
Yeah.
So people would get rained on.
Right.
Watching the show. Not the actors, which I loved. They managed the best guess is that they were under a canopy, but, you know, under an above, but...
I feel cheated.
But yes, exactly.
So the Santa Fe Opera has taken it a step further by covering everybody.
Yes. Everybody. Oh, well, that's a beautiful facility.
That is indeed. Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. And it's the Santa Fe Shakespeare Society, which is on the web at sfshakespeare.org. Jerry and Patrick, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so
much. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Christina McCandless. She's a filmmaker, and her documentary, From Zimbabwe to Santa Fe, screens on Tuesday, July 10th at 7 in the evening at the Screen here in Santa Fe on the College of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. and there will be a Q&A with Christina and two of the women who appear in this film. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm so excited to be here.
What a lovely documentary. It's about a whole world of Zimbabwean basket weavers who were living in very challenging circumstances, really hand-to-mouth, lots of, you don't want to overuse the word poverty, but tough circumstances in Zimbabwe. Weavers, incredible artists, weavers of these amazing baskets, they end up in Folk Art Market in Santa Fe a couple of years ago, and you make a documentary about that. How in the world did you find yourself there in the middle of this story?
Ah, the goddesses must have taken me there. In 2008, I did one day volunteering at the market, actually pre-market, and met a woman named Jane Parsons at a lunch. And she was from Zimbabwe. She happened to be an intern at the market. We began talking. I had my camera with me, and we talked about filmmaking, and then we talked about, well, actually, she said to me, you need to come to Zimbabwe and film our artists. And I said, oh, that's nice, because I would much rather go to Italy or something like that.
Right.
I slept that night. I didn't have a dream, but I woke up the next morning with a revelation that, Christina, do not pass up this opportunity. You have a woman who is willing to open up this whole exotic land and people and give you access that every filmmaker would die for. So do it.
Right.
So from then we sat down like the next week and wrote a quick treatment. And at that time, the New Mexico Film Office was doing the New Visions Film Award. And we quickly sent in, because the deadline was like right that day, we sent in that the application for that award, which is a little bit of funding for New Mexico filmmakers. And we didn't actually get money, but when I got the note that we had been chosen as an alternate, which was, we came up at the top six of the films to possibly get awards, I was like, oh my gosh, I think this film has some legs. We need to really pursue it. Until then, it had been about a three-month wait at that point. I was just kind of vacillating because it was such an incredible commitment. So I immediately got a hold of Jane and I said, we're on, let's go. So that's how it happened. And I worked with a Zimbabwean crew, and she found that crew and went out and found two villages who she knew, because she is like the most renowned crafts expert in Zimbabwe. She's she lives there. She knew villages all over the country, and she knew who was possibly ready to go to the market, who could kind of get their act together, come up with enough inventory, and had the infrastructural resources to get to the market. I had no idea what it was like to get to the market until I went through the process with our artists, but it's quite a process. So she went and got permission from the leadership of each village, the headmen, and then the larger chiefs of each village and each region, for us to film. And my request was, we need to come and film for 2 years. You need to give us permission to go anywhere we want to go for 2 years. And she did. And once we had that, it was full speed ahead. And at that point, it was 18 months till the next market that they could apply for and get into. So we had around 18 months of shooting.
So you were in Zimbabwe for a couple of years almost.
No, I directed this via email, which was also an interesting challenge. I came up with shot lists, which is all of those different shots that I want the cinematographer to take. I tried to describe the style that I wanted as much as possible. I studied a lot of African filmmakers to see what was an indigenous style.
And what was an indigenous style?
It's very sparse and very funny. And very, in terms of editing, it's very in your face. This is what's happening. This person is walking across the street, and we're going to watch this person walk across the street. Whereas here you'd cut and do various different angles. You stay on an angle and you watch a person walk across the street. Or people are trying to make a phone call, and you sit there for 10 minutes watching them suffer through trying to make a phone call. It's very literal, I guess you could say. And also, I did not want to use the cliche Africa. I wanted to show the Africa that these women are from, Zimbabwe. And also in doing this, I learned that Zimbabwe is different than all the other countries in Africa, as all the countries in Africa are different from each other. And
right.
It's really unfair to speak about Africa in general. So,
right. Very important point.
And that has to translate to the film, which I hope it did. So it has a originally my cinematographer does beautiful work, but he did a lot of stuff that was beautiful. And this film has been through a lot of critique because I'm kind of a novice filmmaker. And I've had a lot of great mentors. And a pretty tough mentor said when she saw what I had so far, this is not the film that you say you want to make. And it made me really think about the shots that I had chosen, which were the beautiful shots of them collecting water. And he'd done some great stuff of all of these young women walking in a long line across the desert with their water pails, and very beautiful. There are very few beautiful shots, I think, like that in the film, because that's an American overview. It's not an African day-to-day view of what happens there.
Now, was that a Zimbabwean cinematographer?
Yes. Yes.
And so you're saying the Zimbabwean had an American view, and you, the American, were making it more Zimbabwean?
Unfortunately, he was trained, he got a lot of his training in England. And he's not from the rurals, as they call them. He's from the city. He's from Harare. Spent a lot of time in London and does a lot of traveling all over the world. So, yeah, I had to sort of overrule that, and we went with more nitty-gritty people shots.
Yeah.
Rather than, as you saw it, so you know, than beautiful landscape shots. I have beautiful landscape shots, but they got cut out, and it just tore me up.
I want to see them. You could have released a DVD with the outtakes.
Well, I am. We've done Zimisodes, or we're doing Zimisodes. We have two online right now, and there's so much. It was 108 hours of film, and of course you only end up using an hour and 15 minutes.
Right.
So, and so many interesting cultural discoveries. So we took those and put those in little four-minute pieces that are on the web, but we have a whole thing about school. Both villages going to school, the kids going to school, and what their schooling is like, getting ready in the morning and going.
Nice.
Matron has an episode with the chief,
she's one of the basket weavers.
And she didn't get her visa the first time around, so she had to go to the chief, and it was this huge long hot hike. And I just happened to be there. That was one of the times I was shooting, and we arrive, and he was very imperious and. Hysterical, actually. All we could do is laugh. I had to go away. I couldn't watch the whole scene. It was very serious. She needed a letter from him to take back to the embassy saying, this woman is the oldest of all the children. She will inherit the land, because when you get a visa, you have to prove that you're going to... You have to somehow prove that you're going to come back. You have reason to come back.
Right.
You won't escape.
You won't be an undocumented immigrant to the United States.
Right. Flight risk, as they say, I think.
Right.
So this was an important meeting. But it was pretty funny. So anyways, that's a Zimisode. And on my list of Zimisodes is to do those beautiful shots that didn't get in the film, because there's a really amazing stuff over Lake Kariba, the sunset, the moonrise, the hippos, and all those beautiful to the water hole shots that I know that's daily life, but it still is. There's a certain romance there that I wanted to take out, because this is really not a romantic African continent movie. It's a really nitty gritty about how the normal people there have to deal with certain things.
Yeah, exactly. And so when it became clear that they were going to apply to, or they had this opportunity to apply to the market to get their baskets shown and sold in a foreign country, namely the United States, namely Santa Fe, New Mexico. By the way, we're talking about the film From Zimbabwe to Santa Fe by Christina McCandless, who is sitting with us. Then they have to go through all this stuff, which I would think is as hard for them as, you know, learning to hunt wild game would be for me, namely to fill out applications and deal with grants and credit cards and visa applications and all of that kind of stuff. And they rose to the challenge with so much. What I really noticed about it was equanimity and group spirit.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was a challenge for them, and I hope the audience sees the humanity, our shared humanity. And when some of us are faced with those kind of challenges, we shrink away, And these women, luckily for me as a filmmaker, just were incredibly dynamic in how they approached it. Sindiso, especially, because she, more than any of the other women, took charge of what happened in her village, and because nobody else wanted to do it because it was kind of overwhelming. But she's a woman in her early 40s. She has three children. She's a leader, and her ambition, I hope, comes out in the film. She's very ambitious and wants to be a respected leader among the elders in the community. So she takes this task on without having any idea what it means, and then she brings each of these tasks, like the application, back to the management committee or to the elders who make all the decisions. She can't make any decisions. She can just present things to them and tries to lead them on to enable everyone to go to Santa Fe.
Now, there were a lot of bumps along the road, and we won't give away the film by saying what all these bumps were, but it was very interesting, and some people do end up here. But the amazing thing is, two of the people whom we get to know in the film are actually going to be with you on Tuesday night, talking about the film, and somehow seeing them in real life after having kind of experienced everything they went through in the film, it's almost like, oh, these people
really do exist.
They're real. They're not just film characters.
Exactly. Which is interesting because this is a documentary, so you kind of think, well, they are real. But I think what comes across the documentary, I look at these people as kind of movie stars.
I know. I do too.
They take on this supernatural character. Yeah. Matron and Juliana will be here. And Matron almost didn't get to be here. In the film, I don't think we're spoiling anything by saying there were visa issues when she first applied. And we thought we were over those last year. Matron did come last year, and she was at the Rough Cut screening. So many of the folks who are coming again this year to see the premiere, which is actually a different film than the Rough Cut we showed last year, will have met Matron and Juliana. But this year, I get an email from Juliana that says they didn't approve her visa again. And
Oh, no.
I thought we had this dealt with.
Right.
And they wanted some strange paperwork that I had no idea what it meant. But luckily, we kind of knew at this point, we all have contacts everywhere now. And we all kind of, the Army went into action. And it was about 3 weeks later, she did her second interview, and they approved the visa application then. So it was like, oh, she'll be here. Because she's quite an amazing young woman, and she has faced so many challenges in her life. She's an orphan. She's raised her two sisters. She also takes care of her grandmother and her great-grandmother and their extended families. And she had to drop out of high school to support her families, and her one dream is to go back to high school. So this year, with the help of money, funds that came in, and the help of some of the folks here in northern New Mexico who met her, she's going to a private boarding school in Zimbabwe so she can focus on her education. And it's amazing. She came out to my house last year after market. We were walking. We always walk the dogs. And she's very interested in agriculture, and she picks up, we don't pay any attention to the sand where we walk, she picks up the sand and starts to tell us what its composition is and why it's certainly not going to grow any crops and what we have to do to make it grow crops.
Oh my goodness.
And it's like, oh gosh, this is so great. Because that's what she wants to do. She wants to go back to the village and help everybody.
Yeah.
So that's an exciting, unexpected outcome, I guess, of this whole experience for her. So we're all rooting for Matron.
Now, the baskets that they sell at market, the baskets that they make, are exquisite. And you see some of these in the film, and there is a much older basket weaver in the film who, unfortunately, does not come to Santa Fe in the summer, who makes baskets that came to her in her dreams. I mean, she's one of those truly deeply inspired artists. And as it says somewhere, I can't remember who says it, it's the film, it's like, she weaves and weaves and weaves. When she weaves, she doesn't get hungry, and she doesn't make mistakes.
Yep. Go-Go.
Yeah.
Go-Go is perhaps the most endearing heroine in the film, because she kind of goes...
I love her.
Yeah. Everybody connects with Go-Go, because she's your grandmother. Go-Go means grandmother.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's had a terribly difficult life, but she opens the film by saying, I grew up when this was called, this country was called Rhodesia, when there were lions. And I think that says it all.
Yeah.
She didn't go to school because she had to take care of the cattle and the goats. She too wants to be respected. All of these women really want to be respected for who they are, and that's what motivates them. And she wants her grandchildren, her granddaughters, to respect her for who she is. And her baskets are amazing. As it shows in the film, there's one scene in the kitchen where 10 of Gogo's baskets are there. And they're huge. They're as big as a person is.
Yeah.
And
you could get inside one.
And Cece is the woman who's looking at these and judging these, because she's going to judge what baskets are good enough to go to the market. And she says, oh, these are all Gogo Jabeles? Oh my gosh, she's certainly been busy, hasn't she? And that's just so true. Gogo's out there in the fields, growing what she's going to eat the next year. And then when she gets done, she comes back and starts weaving.
Right.
And doesn't make a mistake. Her little hands are going all the time. She's always doing a basket. Somebody's always carrying her baskets. Her baskets are in everybody's homesteads. You always see a go-go basket there because she uses the signature white and green. And the other interesting thing about Msendu, that community where go-go is, they've run out of the reeds that they originally used to make the baskets. There are no more. So they started...
Went extinct in that area,
yeah,
so to speak?
Yeah, they're over...
Overgrazed, not whatever. Overgrazed, over-harvested.
Perhaps, or overgrazed, or, land is reused or used for agriculture versus taking the natural resources off of it for crafts.
Right.
They started using... There are these huge, anything plastic, let's just do, anything plastic is cut into strips and used in the baskets. So the reeds are used in the coil, but they're covered with, instead of the alala that they would normally be covered with, they're covered with this plastic. And Gogo seems to find white and green plastic. So everything she makes is made of that, those plastics. And when I was there and talking about what they were making, that potato chip bags, yeah, trash, anything totally recycled into these baskets.
And but they don't look like it.
No There's Cece holds in one of the scenes, she holds something that's kind of sparkly and really glitzy, and that's the inside a foil of a potato chip bag.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, talk about recycling.
Yeah it's wonderful, and the sense of design and color is unsurpassed.
We're talking about the film From Zimbabwe to Santa Fe, which is screening tomorrow night, Tuesday, the 10th of July at 7 o'clock at the Screen here in Santa Fe. What do we know? You don't really go into it that much in the film, but what do we know about the history and tradition of that kind of basket making?
That basket making has always been, it's an ongoing craft in Msendu. As Gogo said, Gogo's 70 years old, and she's been doing this since she was a small child, and she was taught by her elders to do it. So that's been going on forever. And that style of basket represents that side of Zimbabwe, the southwestern side of Zimbabwe that borders on South Africa and Botswana. And up in Siasundu, where Matron's community lives, that culture is Tongan, and they share that culture with some of the southernmost Zambian tribes. So it's very similar. If you go to the market and you see Zambian baskets, they look like the Tongan baskets from Siasundu. They're very, very similar. That community, that area, was on the verge of losing those basket-making skills. But over the course of the last... Well, it started about perhaps 20 years ago. Several people were making an effort to bring it back, and they got NGOs, non-governmental agencies, to come in and support the revitalization of the basket-making industry. And it was going very well. They were actually setting up horizontally integrated, or vertically integrated, I never get those, where folks were growing the alala, Folks were then making the baskets. People were teaching the skills of basket making and the cultural patterning that goes on with the baskets. And then, in particular, the Binga Craft Center was marketing the baskets, primarily to South Africa. And things were going really, really well. And there were about 600 basket makers that were being revenue generated. You can't say supported, but revenue was being generated by the sale of their baskets until the last 5 years when the government, that area up in northwestern Zimbabwe is very independent from the politics, and because they do not go along with the dictator, their portion of the country has been totally cut off from any kind of governmental subsidies or governmental services. And also over the course of time, because of that, the NGOs have backed off. And the dire state of the government and the economy in Zimbabwe, all these NGOs have left, most of them European, and they sort of left the basket makers hanging. They took the infrastructure with them, and so the Binga Craft Center now sits there. And Matabeki, who is in the film, mentions that everything was kind of going okay, and then they lost support. And because he can't get out to collect the baskets, even though he now has the market to sell them, he can't walk the kilometers and carry the baskets at the same time.
Right. It's basically all they need is a pickup truck kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The whole thing was a domino effect, and when he couldn't sell them, then they stopped making them. And about 10 years of work to build up the industry kind of fell apart. It was a domino effect and fell apart. So now this was a great opportunity to expand in a different way, the basket sales. And Zimbabwe does have an international festival of arts where they all gather in Harare, and it is international, and I was lucky enough to go to it. And a lot of the craftspeople come and they sell their crafts there. But it's, the market is limited. And because a lot of folks are local, they're not as entranced by the crafts
right.
as the foreigners are. So they don't sell as much. It's an outlet for them, yeah, but it's they just don't sell as much as they'd like to. So, it's difficult. It's a difficult situation.
Yeah, yeah. Now, watching the film From Zimbabwe to Santa Fe, it focuses on women because women are the basket weavers in that society. And one of the characters says, I would have liked to pass this on, but I didn't have any daughters. And it's like, I guess boys just don't weave baskets. But you see women growing crops. You see them tilling the soil. You see them making baskets. You see them basically, what do the men do?
That's a question. That's such a good question. Okay, so the men are the leaders, and they sit around and talk about leading. And I'm not going to disparage the men because they're very kind and they do have their place, but they joke about their own positions in the community, and they kind of take pride in the fact that the women do everything, and it's a pride that's shaded by perhaps a little anxiety and humor. Let me tell you the story, and it gives you a better picture. The kitchen huts have bancos around. Everything's made of adobe around the walls. And we did a kitchen tour my first visit there. It's a lot of kitchens. And the men talk about their kitchen while their wife talks about the design of what she's done in terms of, because she built it. He says, and the men, their place where they sit is right here next to the door. So they can leave really quickly. Because evidently they take a lot of heat from their wives for not doing enough.
Oh boy!
So when things get
when hot, they're
out of there.
Yeah, they don't. One doesn't get the impression. I mean, when they speak, they're eminently reasonable and likable and friendly. You don't get a sort of macho attitude or something like that at all. But yeah, there was this question of, what do they do? That's very odd.
It is very odd. Now, to be fair, most of the, in the film you see young teenage up to like the age of 20, and then you see older men. You don't see a lot of middle-aged men. They're all out in South Africa and Botswana working.
Ah, so they're the migrant labor in richer African countries.
It's huge. There's also nobody... AIDS is there, but it's a totally integrated part of society, so it's not something that they wave flags about. But a lot of that middle generation is gone, period.
Oh,
a lot of
no.
orphans that, like Gogo's taking care of
yeah.
grandchildren. They go to grandparents. In Masendu, they have this whole structure that takes care of orphans. Of the food that is grown, 10% of it is given to a fund, which is that food is then distributed to those families who have adopted AIDS orphans. So there, it's a little bit more complex, and I certainly don't want to indict the men for not doing anything.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't see them doing a lot of the hard labor. In Siasundu, it's a different scene. Those men are all out doing labor that you didn't see. They built a school during the 18 months I was there. During one of the shoots, they were digging latrines for the school, which is a huge, laborious process that probably took 2 or 3 weeks to do. And they were building a market, a roadside market, to sell the baskets to tourists because they felt they needed a better way to reach the tourists.
I guess what it really made me think about when I was watching your film was there has been a tremendous amount of focus in the last decade or so, maybe more, in education of women and girls in third world countries and micro loans to women starting businesses. And this kind of gives you a sense of why that's so important mm-hmm. in a society like what we see in Zimbabwe in this film.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what's really also very interesting is that the girls, everybody goes to elementary school. That's sort of mandated. And I guess the first bit of cash you get goes to pay the school fees for elementary school. But in secondary school, the boys are the ones that get priority to go to elementary school. If there's any cash in the family, you pay for the boys. So the girls also end up not getting any education, you know, as you mentioned. But then the boys also leave to find jobs elsewhere. One of our translators, who I would have to call him a line producer, who was the son of the headman in Matron's village, incredibly talented furniture maker, woodworker, and he also did all of our translation when he was there. The last visit I made, he had gone. He had left the village and gone to Bulawayo, which is the second largest town in Zimbabwe, to try to find work. And that was like the saddest thing to see this proud, beautiful man. Because I was in Bulawayo, went to see him, and he's standing in line with 10,000 other men
to find
work
right.
each day.
The film is called From Zimbabwe to Santa Fe, and the focus on these wonderful basket weavers who are going to be not only at the film tomorrow night, but also at Folk Art Market.
Matron and Juliana will be there.
Mm-hmm. And Christina McCandless is the filmmaker. Tomorrow she will be at the screen at 7 o'clock. The screen is the wonderful movie theater on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Is there a website for the film?
Yes, FromZimbabweToSantaFe.com.
FromZimbabweToSantaFe.com. Christina, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.